Welcome back to the program. Why is it that poor children seem to do consistently worse academically than middle-class kids? On the other hand, why do some wealthy children fail and sometimes break down, while at the same time kids from some of the mean streets of our urban neighborhoods can reach monumental heights? Is it just IQ or temperament? Or is there something else? Something else that has to do with the innate character and perseverance of the child? Our guest today, Paul Tough, who introduced many of us to the work of Jeffrey Canada in the Harlem Children's Zone, and who is a contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine, has spent years reporting on what makes kids succeed and fail in school. His new book is entitled How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Paul Tough, thanks so much for being back with us again.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. One of the overriding points that you make is that so much of what we're learning about kids, about the way they develop, about the way their brains work, is just not reflected in the way that we're approaching education today.
That's right. What I try to do in this book is take on the conventional wisdom that I think is misguided in terms of what we emphasize about teaching our kids. I think for a lot of us, and for a long time, we've thought that the one skill that really matters in a child's success is IQ, is that sort of narrow range of cognitive skills that gets measured on achievement tests. But the scientists that I've been looking at and the experimental innovations that I've been writing about are looking at a very different set of skills, things like curiosity and grit, self-control, perseverance, optimism. And one of the interesting things about those, the way that people are looking at those skills now, is you talked about that innate character. When we talk about character, we tend to think of something that is fixed in place. But what these scientists are talking about is skills that go very deep, that are those sorts of deep qualities, but that are changeable, that kids can change in themselves, and that teachers and parents can help children change.
What are we finding, though, about the nexus between the development of these skills and the IQ of these particular kids?
Well, there's definitely correlations, but actually they're often not that connected. There are kids who are, don't test well on standardized tests that measure IQ, but have incredible amounts of grit and perseverance. And in those cases, when you find kids like that, they actually do very well. And the reverse is true as well. There are kids who have great IQs but don't have the ability to show up in school every day, to put off gratification for the future, even to just be curious and interested in what they're learning. And those kids run into lots of trouble, not only in school, but later on as well.
And one of the things you talk about is that this has to do not just with learning to fail, but really how kids learn to deal with failure when it does happen.
Absolutely. So failure is this word that came up a lot in my reporting, which might be surprising for a book about success. But a lot of the teachers that I talked about how, especially in affluent communities, the kids are very protected now from any kind of adversity, and that there's no opportunity to fail. And so, in large quantities, failure can be really terrible. It obviously does very bad things to kids. But if kids are completely protected from failure, they miss out on the opportunity to build character. It's something I think a lot of us recognize from our own lives. It's in those moments where we fail, deal with it ourselves, pick ourselves up, and start again, that we really grow, that we really develop our character, and that's absolutely true for kids.
And that's certainly true later in life, but one of the things you also look at is what science is telling us and what we're learning about the impact of stress when these kids are very young, and that's not always positive.
You're absolutely right. So, and it's one of the complicated things, I think, about both parenting and education, which is that I think you're right. Later in childhood and in adolescence, certainly what kids need is moderate amounts of adversity. In the first year or two of life, adversity doesn't help at all. And really what the job of parents at that point, I think, really is to protect their kids from adversity, to help them learn how to manage stress. I hadn't known before I started working on this book the research on the often devastating impact that early stress, what some scientists call toxic stress, can have on kids when they grow up in a really chaotic environment with abuse or neglect or violence or even just instability in the home and in their communities. You can actually see the effect on their brains, not just in their behavior, but when you do brain scans, it actually affects the way that certain parts of their brains are affected. And the skills that are affected by early stress are the ones that are arguably most important in school success.
And what do we understand about why certain kids are able to overcome that early damage from that stress and others don't? Is it something that we find is reversible? What does the science tell us about that?
It is reversible. I'll say one thing before I talk about it being reversible, which is that it is also possible, I think, to protect kids from that kind of chaos. And the weapon that is most effective at protecting them is parents. Some of the research that I found most striking in this book is that if you take two kids and they're both raised in a pretty difficult, adverse environment, if one has a close relationship with a parent or caregiver, what psychologists call a secure attachment, that makes a huge difference. Those kids are mostly insulated from the negative effects of that stress. But if they don't have that experience, that's when the real damage happens. In terms of reversing it, it's not easy, but there are definitely therapies and interventions that can work both inside the school context and out. There are some that work as late as adolescence, but it's early childhood when that's the easiest time to reverse that damage.
One of the other aspects of this character that you talk about is the idea of self-control. What do you mean by that, and what have we come to understand?
So self-control is a psychological category. The word I actually like better is self-regulation, because I think that's more what it feels like. It's not just being sort of rigidly controlled and following rules and following orders. It's about being able to control your impulses and your emotions. I think this is something that a lot of us can relate to. And it's a very positive thing for kids, and it's an especially important skill for them to learn at age 4 and 5 and 6. And when kids have trouble with self-control, when they can't control their thoughts, control their emotions, control their impulses, when they get into preschool and kindergarten, that's often when they run into trouble, because it's those skills that are really helpful in terms of being able to sit still, to concentrate, to follow directions, to understand what's going on in the classroom.
One of the other aspects of character that you talk about is this sense of optimism that many kids have. Where does that come from? What do we understand about the impact of it?
So the field of positive psychology, which is one of the things that I read about in the book, is all about this idea of learned optimism. I think some people are more naturally optimistic, and growing up with a lot of adversity does not help with one's optimism or outlook on life. But what's profound to me about the idea of learned optimism is that this is something that is changeable, that you can actually take steps to reframe what's going on in your life in a more positive way. And that can sound sort of Pollyanna-ish, just, sort of smiling through trauma. But I think in reality, there's a way to do it that, and a way to help kids do it, that can let them see setbacks as temporary and not something that speaks intensely to their identity, and that lets them really celebrate their triumphs. And when this happens, when kids are able to reframe what's going on in their lives in a way that makes them feel more optimistic and like they have more agency, there are real changes in terms of how well they can do. They're able to stick with tasks for longer. They're able to take more risks, to take on bigger projects. So I think it can really pay off.
How much of that is a genetic component? Because we do see kids that are just more naturally joyous.
You're right. I think the research is unclear about how much of it is genetic, because the problem with trying to divide these things is that, those kids who are naturally joyous, we don't know what happened to them in their first year of life. A lot of what seems like just natural temperament, I think, is really affected by the environment. But I think sure, there are kids who, for whether through genes or the environment, are naturally one way or the other. I think the problem with how we often look at character is that we then tend towards thinking that things are innate, and that means that they're fixed. I think one of the important messages in this whole book is that character can change. And I think even giving that message to kids, I think kids hear the opposite message a lot. They hear, you're either this kid or this kind of kid or that kind of kid. You're a happy kid or a sad kid. You're a troubled kid or a successful kid. And hearing those messages, I think, can be really damaging. Hearing the opposite message, that you can change, I think, is really important.
How does all of this relate to what we're trying to do in terms of more early childhood education?
I think it's really important. I think that, you know, right now when we talk about early childhood education, we're often talking about those cognitive skills, about reading and math, and there's this, I think for a lot of parents, this anxiety that they've got to get all these cognitive skills into their kids' head really early. It's what some economists call the rug rat race. Getting into the right preschool on time, getting, you know, the right scores on all those early worksheets and tests. But I think for a lot of kids, what's important about those early childhood years is developing these other skills. And so a lot of early childhood interventions, whether they're trying to or not, I think are actually doing a very good job of developing these skills. And there are some. There's one I write about called Tools of the Mind that's a pre-K and kindergarten program that's all about self-regulation, that is specifically trying to help kids develop these skills. And I think that kind of focus is really useful in those early years.
How much of a problem is this for middle-class kids that may have better IQs but really aren't getting the focus on these more executive functions?
I think it's a big deal. I think you know, the way that we've constructed our school system, and especially for the last decade or more with No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, we are pushing teachers and school systems and principals to focus only on the skills that can be measured on tests. And I think for every kid, certainly middle-class kids, but rich and poor kids as well, there's lots of evidence that just having their teachers focus on how to raise their test scores is denying them the ability to deal with all these other skills.
And in fact, one of the things that we're hearing often from business is that kids are coming out of educational systems today, even with high IQs and a lot of academic knowledge, that are missing these skills.
Right. I think the sense of initiative and entrepreneurialism, just being able to figure out a problem for yourself. I've heard the same thing from employers who are used to employees with I think first of all they're used to employees with more of those skills. But then I also think that our workplaces are changing. And in the past, I think we've had an education system that prepared people for the jobs of the 1950s, whether that was working in an office where everyone just follows orders, or working in a factory where everyone just follows orders. Mm-hmm. And I think that in a lot of modern workplaces, you still need self-regulation. You need the ability to understand instructions, but you also need the ability to be flexible, to find unexpected solutions to a problem. And those are skills that don't get developed when you follow a very narrow curriculum.
Right. There was an interesting line, and I can't remember right this second whose it was, coming out of the Democratic Convention last week, where somebody said you can't be pro-business without being pro-education. I mean, it's the whole point of what we're saying.
And I think there's a lot of business people who agree. One thing that really strikes me in terms of the philanthropy that goes on around education is how many business people feel that, and I think it's because of hiring. I think they feel that if they want to have the workers of tomorrow, not to mention the customers of tomorrow, they need to have kids who are better at developing all kinds of skills.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is how this affected you personally, having a young child.
Yes. So my son is now three, just turned three this summer, and so he was born just as I was starting into the reporting and the research on this book, and it affected me a lot. I think when he was born, I was, like a lot of parents, I was really anxious and obsessed with his cognitive development, and I thought, you know, I needed to break out the Baby Einstein DVDs and the Mozart CDs and the maternity ward, where he wouldn't make it into the right preschool and he'd be doomed. A lot of this research is pretty intense, but one of the things that was interesting to me about it is that it actually made me more relaxed as a parent. It actually gave me the message that, especially in the first few years of life, what matters is his relationship with me and with my wife. And that his cognitive skills, I definitely care. I want him to be able to read and do math. But I think that what matters most, especially in his first few years, are his character skills. And using that term, I think, can seem strange when you're talking about a toddler. But I really believe that the things that he's learning right now that are most important are how to manage his emotions, how to deal with stress, how to respond to situations. That stuff is going to set him on a path for a successful education and a successful life, so much more than any worksheets or DVDs I could be giving.
The other side of that, though, is that we haven't really evolved a clear-cut curriculum with respect to how we teach or instill those things.
You're right, and it is a real challenge. I mean, there are some, I write in the book about some innovations that I think are really worth pursuing. The Tools of the Mind curriculum is one of them. There are some high school curriculums that I think are really helpful for kids. But it's not as easy. I mean, I think that's part of the reason why we don't emphasize those skills is that, you know, school systems need a curriculum that you kind of take off the shelf and put in the school. And we have those for reading and math. We do not have those for grit and curiosity. You can't get better at grit just by, you know, doing more grit homework or, you know, doing self-control worksheets. And so it's a challenge to the education system. And what I find heartening is that there are a lot of individual teachers and schools that are really responding to that challenge and realizing these are questions we've got to answer.
Talk about that in your reporting on this. Where are the places, the schools here in this country or anywhere else for that matter, where they are focusing on these character and grit skills, and how are they doing it?
So one of the biggest experiments that I write about in the book is taking place at two schools in New York City, very different schools. One, KIPP Infinity, is a charter middle school serving mostly low-income kids. The other is Riverdale Country School, which is a private school where tuition just passed $40,000 a year. And these two schools are actually collaborating on trying to develop a more scientific curriculum for character. They have worked with some psychologists at the University of Pennsylvania to identify seven character strengths that they say are the most important to emphasize. Some of the ones we've been talking about, grit, self-control, curiosity, also gratitude, social intelligence, zest. And so they are still trying to figure out exactly how best to teach them. They do something called dual-purpose instruction, where they talk about these skills constantly in class. But one of the innovations that I actually think is most important is they've developed what they first called it a character report card at KIPP. They've since named it the character growth card. And it lets each teacher at KIPP Infinity grade each student in the school four times a year on these character strengths. It's not a traditional report card. You don't get held back for not having enough zest. But it gives the teachers a way to talk to the kids and a way to measure these skills, even if it's somewhat subjective. But it kind of becomes a conversation piece between the parents, the teachers, and the kids to talk about, well, why is it a big deal that you don't have enough curiosity? What could you do to develop that?
Talk about that curiosity and how we instill that, how we enforce it, teach it, so that it becomes part of lifelong learning. I mean, the kind of thing that, for example, Tom Friedman was talking about in his column yesterday.
Right. Well, I mean, I think we don't enforce it. I think that's the solution. I think, you know, so certainly I feel this having a three-year-old. Kids are naturally curious. I think this is sort of almost a cliche about the education system, but what the education system often does is, you know, beats curiosity out of kids. And there's a lot about the kind of curricula that we often use that does not emphasize independent learning and just following your interests where they lead. And I think that's true up including at some very high-performing schools. You know, I feel like when I was in high school, I was really interested in math and science, but I wasn't that good at it. And so I wasn't encouraged to take those classes, and I didn't take the risk of taking those classes because I didn't want to lower my GPA. But I think when kids are just encouraged to, try something difficult, try something different, try something you're not necessarily good at, but you're just curious about, you're just passionate about, they respond. They've got curiosity in huge amounts when they enter the school system.
Is this something that we understand enough about that we can scale it up if there was the will to do it?
I think there are some things in my book that we're ready to scale up now. I think there are some interventions with parents, especially in disadvantaged communities early on, that are having really remarkable results in terms of how they affect that parent's relationship with their children and thus the children's ability to develop these non-cognitive skills. I think there are a couple of high school interventions, again, mostly in disadvantaged communities, that I think are the kind of curricula that could be expanded pretty quickly. But there's a whole lot that we don't know. I think the thing that we do know, and that the message I'm trying to get across in this book, is that we know these skills are really important. The thing we're still figuring out is exactly how to teach them and how to develop them. And so where I'm trying to push people is to say that's the big question to ask next.
Is there a certain irony in the fact that we're seeing more efforts in this area in some disadvantaged schools and communities?
Yes, I think, I think that, you know, I think we always sort of focus on disadvantaged communities, and partly for good reason, to say this is where, you know, the school system is most broken. And it is. I think these kids are really, you know, I reported a lot on the south side of Chicago, and there are kids in those neighborhoods who are way behind in all kinds of ways and really have difficult environments that they're growing up in, and they need a lot more help. But I was really struck, that was kind of the kind of reporting that I started off doing in the book. I was really struck by spending time at Riverdale Country School by this feeling, certainly among the administrators, but also among the teachers and the parents, that this was a problem for their kids as well, and in some cases a really big problem, that the first-class education system that they had developed was making these kids great test takers, putting a lot of pressure and stress on them, but it wasn't giving them that kind of experiences that would really develop their character.
Paul Tough, the book is How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Paul, it's always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you very much. It was great.
Thank you.